And good morning to you. I'm Ellen Speer, and you're listening to Morning Drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. Thank you so much for spending the morning with us today. I have in the studio with me a wonderful guest, Carol Goodman Kaufman, a writer of murder mysteries, among other things, and we'll be talking about the realm of writing, the influence of place, a place like the Berkshires, and many other things that we have in common. Welcome, Carol.
Thank you so much for having me, Ellen.
You're quite welcome. And your latest book is?
The most recent is Crack Bam Dead, which is a collection of short, cozy mystery stories in which a group of Mahjong players solve murders.
Do they do that while they're playing or in
they
the course of
They discuss various clues, various pieces of evidence while they're playing. But no, they're not actually solving the crime while they're playing.
And betting at the same time. So when you confront a mystery, do you plan out the entire thing and the entire plot and where the twists are going to be and how it's going to be resolved from the beginning, or do you let it go?
If only I were that well organized. I have an idea, and I have a basic outline, but the story grows organically, and sometimes it can change altogether. The characters grow on me. I want them to grow. I don't want them to be static. There are some characters out there in mystery land who never grow, never change, and I want mine to develop as human beings.
And do they tell you what they want to do next sometimes?
Sometimes they do talk to me, mostly in the shower.
Yeah, and so you're thinking about what the days... Do you have a set program that you you write between X and X and try to turn out so many pages a day, or do you just let that happen?
I do have a goal in my head. I would love to be able to produce 1,000 words a day. Usually end up around 500, although yesterday I hit 876. So you never know.
And it depends on the day.
It depends on the day.
Now, Crack Barn Dead has been described, I think, as a cozy mystery. What is that genre?
Cozy is a mystery that involves an amateur detective. In this case, the Mahjong ladies. It's not a hard-boiled. It's not noir. There's so many different subcategories in the mystery genre. But the cozy, you'll see often with very clever titles, like mine says Crack Bam Dead. Crack and Bam are two of the suits in the Mahjong game. So people who know Mahjong will see Crack Bam and recognize
it. I get that. And the Berkshires inspires you as well. That's been almost a character in some of your books.
In the first murder, absolutely, and in the upcoming sequel, I set the story in the fictional Berkshire Hills village of Queensbridge, which people have told me, actually people in the town in which I live, West Stockbridge, have told me, you know what we need here? We need a diner, because quite a bit of the action takes place in the Queen Bee Diner. So, yeah, it's definitely Berkshire heavy.
And would readers recognize that street, that main street in West Stockbridge, from reading your book?
No, probably not. But they will recognize Tanglewood. They'll recognize the 413 beer. They'll recognize many, many other aspects of Berkshire life.
And you write other kinds of genres, too.
Yes. My very first book 20 years ago was nonfiction based on research I did as a criminology postdoc. And then I continued doing work in violence, but then I hit a brick wall, basically, working on a story. It was on a research project interviewing formerly active violent extremists. Violent extremists who had turned their lives around, whether they were gangbangers, white supremacists, neo-Nazis, they had turned their lives around. There are very few of that category that have turned their lives around. But listening to their stories, including assassination, including bashing people's heads in with shovels, I hit a wall. I wrote the first draft of the book. It's still sitting there, still sitting on my desk, but I just could not do a second go through it. It hurt me too much. So I realize the irony of writing murder mysteries now. That conflict is not lost on me.
Yeah.
But with mystery, there's always a solution. There's justice in the end. It's like a puzzle. And I love puzzles. They tell you that you need to do puzzles to keep your brain sharp. So to me, that's the mystery is the ultimate puzzle.
Yeah. And so you have academic experience mm-hmm. with the criminology field and mm-hmm. also psychology.
Yeah, my psychology doctorate is in industrial and organizational psychology, and this is where you can fall asleep.
Well, some of that could be criminal, too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely not a normal population. People think, you won't be working with anything too outlandish, but you'd be surprised at the kind of behavior. Well, you read about it in the papers.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So what is it that you find in people who have done those kinds of crimes? Is there a through line that you've noticed, a kind of trait that you can identify that this is a person who might have that tendency, or is each individual come at it for a different reason?
Well, I can only speak to, let's say, the violent extremists.
Yes.
Every single one that I spoke with had experienced abuse of some type. In fact, several types, usually.
Yeah.
Physical abuse, emotional abuse, financial, social isolation, just horrible, horrible things. And they join their gangs or the neo-Nazi group or the terrorist group because they were accepted and they were prized. They were made to feel loved. They felt that they now had a family, whereas in their own biological family, they didn't feel that way.
I can't help but draw a little parallel to what we're seeing in some factions in the world. Do you see that as well?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. People want to belong somewhere. And if they're not made to feel loved and protected, safe, secure, I believe that they will find some place where they will be.
Yeah. And is there some through line also with the people who recruit people who have those tendencies?
I didn't actually study those people.
Yeah.
I wonder what their upbringing was like. Why do they need to be that way? But I don't have any expertise in that area.
Yeah. They must have been able to recognize those types, though.
Recognize vulnerable people. You see that whether it's recruiting for a militaristic group or recruiting sex slaves, recruiting child sex objects. You can see who needs it. The child whose father left, a child whose father died needs a father figure. And that leads to exploitation. There's a lot of bad stuff going on out there.
So how do you turn that around into a novel that I'm going to want to sit down and read without starting to cry?
Well, I'd like to say, as you mentioned earlier, the setting is so important. And that's why setting a murder mystery in the Berkshires sets up a dichotomy right there. Here's a gorgeous place, great magnet for culture. People come flocking to the Berkshires for the music, the dance, the theater. I mean, this is the place to spend the summer. How can something that beautiful, in a place that beautiful, have a murder go on, and why? What was the motivation for whoever it is mm-hmm. to commit a murder?
And it's women who are solving these murders.
In the Cozies, yes. In the first murder, it's the police chief who solves the murder with the help of his team, one of whom is not actually a police officer. She is a wheelchair-bound dispatcher because she was injured very badly in a motorcycle accident. She had hoped to become, she had actually hoped to go into the military, but due to her injury, she works in the police department, and she's probably one of the smartest people in the team.
And do you model your characters after people that you run into or good friends? Or where's your inspiration for those characters?
I have no idea. That, Ellen, is the magic of writing. You never know where it's going to come. The other day, I was my sister-in-law gave me some Rose of Sharon offshoots because she mistakenly, inadvertently, bought non-sterile Rose of Sharon.
Yeah.
So as I'm digging into the ground to plant one, my shovel hits a rock.
Ooh.
And I think, ooh, I think the Mahjong group should decide to bury a time capsule. And while they're burying the while they're digging to bury the time capsule, they're going to find somebody else's time capsule. Mm-hmm. And in the time capsule, there will be a photograph of a group of kids, and one of them has gone missing from 30 years before. And that'll
But only because
I was digging to plant a bush did I come up with that story. You never know where they're going to come from.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. And you have another name for your other kind of writing, which is Carolinda.
Yes.
And that's for your children's stories. I assume they're not murder mysteries.
No, they are not. They're all nature-based.
Okay.
Yes, Carolinda Goodman is my maiden name. And as a kid, I did not like Carolinda, but now I like it because it differentiates the adult work from the children's books. Children today are so computer savvy. I did not want any of my grandchildren going online and reading anything about domestic violence, which is my first book. I didn't want them reading anything that would have to do with the kinds of crime that happened in the first murder. So I write under the name Carolinda Goodman, and that was just to keep it separate.
Tell us about your children's books.
Okay, well, the first one is called Once in a Full Moon. They're all picture books, these three, and it's about that every page is, it's all taught, they're all taught, written in rhyme, and they tell the story, this one tells the stories behind the names of the full moons every month. So the strawberry moon, the harvest moon, the elk moon, that kind of thing. The buck moon. The second one is called Pirate Ships and Shooting Stars, and it's about using your imagination when you look up in the sky. What do you see? Just because it says that's the Big Dipper may be something different to you.
Yeah.
With that. And the third one is called Detective Bears and Friends. It's about all the sometimes funny names that groups of animals go by. So a gang of elks. My favorite is a lounge of lizards. So, and that's really... the illustrations are just terrific.
And who is your illustrator?
I have several different illustrators.
Yes.
I've used that one. They're all different.
And do you work on them together, the images and the words, or you turn over the words and let your illustrator use their imagination?
Yes, and we talk back and forth. For example, the gang of elks. I wanted a motorcycle gang. I wanted leather clad with the chains. The whole thing. I wanted that. But they're on motorcycles. It's terrific.
Yeah.
And the lounge of lizards are lounging, and they have the heavy gold chains around their neck.
Yeah. Yeah.
They look like lounge lizards.
Do you intersperse your murder mysteries with the children's books to clear your palate, or were you on a children's book jag for a while and then moved over to the murder mysteries?
Sort of back and forth. I'm probably the most disorganized writer you'll ever come across.
Why do you say that?
Because I will think I'm working on two different things right now, and plus we're submitting the illustrations this afternoon for my new children's book, which is not a picture book. It's a collection of stories based in a Florida swamp.
Mm-hmm.
I just go back and forth depending on what is in my head.
Yeah.
What's in my head at that point. And the book I'm working on now actually is historical fiction. So
can you give us a clue? The setting, at least, or the time period, something?
The time period? Well, it starts in 1814, and it takes place, the bulk of the action takes place in Pittsfield and in Worcester.
And how did you learn about Worcester?
Well, I live there.
Ah, that'll do it. So you know the roads there, and you know the important places there.
One of the exciting things about Worcester is that it is the home of the American Antiquarian Society, which is the coolest place.
Isn't it? It is a fabulous collection and great stuff.
Every printed word from the before the Revolution till the end of the 19th century. It's a fabulous place to do research. And that is where the ritual item that is found in Pittsfield is sent to Worcester.
Ah.
And my character is trying to find it.
Mm-hmm. And do you have to be a bona fide researcher to use that or be working on a particular piece? Or can anybody come in and research something?
You need to have a card.
Yeah, yeah.
But the staff there is tremendously helpful. They're wonderful to work with. It's a great place.
Yeah. And I know. I when I go into a place like that, I wind up down rabbit holes because something is really interesting to me. And I'm like, wow, I'm never going to use it for anything, but it's just of personal interest to me. Do you find those eddies and byways when you go in and start to read?
That is the most exciting part, particularly for this book. Yeah. With fiction, you're making up a lot and you may need some, you know, factual information. But with this, historical fiction is new to me. I haven't done it before and I'm having so much fun. And rabbit hole is probably the best description of how my day goes. I never know what's going to happen when I open up the internet, and just changing a word in the search can bring you down a totally different path. And I love that. It's very exciting.
Yeah.
And then putting it together is that's the challenge. Yeah.
So are you a note card person? Are you a stick it up on the wall person? Are you a keeper of notebooks? How do you organize your information? Because it sounds like you're gathering many different things from many different sources, and they may wind up in this book or some other book.
Some of it will, and quite a bit of it will. I have two different storylines, and so I have two different files. Here, I'm talking with my hands here.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
So what I do is I have a timeline for both of the characters, and I want to make sure that the modern character is writing something that goes along with what the 1815 character is doing.
So it's two parallel timelines, one present, one past.
Yes. The premise of the story is that, well, I'm not sure if you knew this or not. Many people don't. But the largest prisoner of war camp during the War of 1812 was here in Pittsfield.
I did not know that.
On the common where I grew up ice skating.
Yeah.
Because I do come from Pittsfield.
Wow.
And my character, I believe, was a prisoner of war captured during the Battle of Lake Champlain, September of 1814. He's brought to Pittsfield, but because he's an officer, he has more privileges. The regular soldiers were allowed to go out to work. The officers didn't have to, but my character wants to work. He works at a farm out in the western part of the city on Fort Hill and is robbed of a very important item to him.
Mm-hmm.
He never finds it.
Yeah, yeah. But now, why do you think, why was Pittsfield such a center? I know it was an important city during the post-revolution, but why was this such an important place to have a big camp just where the fighting happened to be?
I think a lot of it had to do with Thomas Melville, who was the commandant of the POW camp, and he was quite enlightened. Unlike prisoner encampments in England, where people were tortured, they were starved, they lived in terribly unsanitary conditions. Thomas Melville was quite progressive for his time. He wanted to treat his internees as human beings. Some of it might have been political, because he wanted to convert them, perhaps. Some people, some British prisoners accused him of trying to convert them to become Americans, to like Americans, which, if that was in fact his intent, then he was brilliant.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
many did stay here afterwards because they were treated so well, and the officers could interact with the soldiers could interact with the people in the town. They would go to dances. They could work and earn money, and of course, the money they earned, they would then spend in the town. I mean, it was quite brilliant, actually.
Yeah. It's really interesting and different from the times today. Mm-hmm. Now, we share another great interest, and that's Nancy Drew.
Oh, yes.
Did you read all of them?
I believe I did.
I did, too, starting with number one and working all the way through. What was it about her for you? We'll compare notes.
Well, I just want to say the very first one I bought was at the Berkshire Athenaeum book sale for a quarter.
Uh-huh.
And that was the first one, the clock, Secret of the Old Clock.
Yes.
What did I like? I loved the fact that she had these friends, Bess and George, and Ned was in there too.
Right.
She drove a coupe.
Cool
convertible.
Car.
And she wore frocks. I mean, those are the original. She wore frocks.
Yeah.
I just loved the fact that she would use her brain to solve a problem. I've never been an athlete. I do exercise every day, but I'm not an athlete by any means. And I love the fact that she used her brain to solve the problems. And she did get into trouble sometimes. She got into danger.
And for me, it was always kind of interesting that she blended the time in which they were written, where women had a very traditional role,
right,
with being a modern woman and kind of stepping away from that and it all being okay. And maybe it's because she was so brilliant.
And she was an only child, and her mother was gone, right? Her mother had died.
Yeah.
So her father was busy with his law practice, right?
Yes.
He really wasn't supervising so much.
Yeah, it really is a modern story in a lot of ways, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you still have all of them?
No, I have a few in the house, but no, I do not have the set. I'm trying to pare down, actually.
I found them beginning to end. I couldn't put them down. It didn't matter what else was going on. I had to start after school because I wasn't going to stop till I was done every time I picked one up. I don't know if you had the same.
Yeah, my mother used to tell me, "Carol, stop reading. You're going to strain your eyes. You're going to get a headache."
Right, right.
But those were page turners.
Yeah, they really were. And did that really set the stage for you to love mysteries in a way?
Even earlier, I read The Happy Hollisters. I'm not sure.
Tell me about that. I don't know those.
It was a family of happy Hollisters.
Right.
In fact, I drove past Hollister Ave today on the way here. I said, "Oh, happy Hollisters." They were family, and they would go on adventures. I remember they went to Indian River. They went to Cape Canaveral. They would solve crimes. But to this day, an image, that because there were illustrations, one of the images in one of the first stories I read was of a man in a ski cap climbing through their cellar window to break into the house. It terrified me. And I still remember that illustration because it was so potent. And that's what visuals can help so much in the story. That's why description is so important.
Did that influence, would you call that a cozy mystery because of the coming through the door like that, or does that push it into more violent
stuff? No, I guess the Happy Hollisters were all children, so they would definitely be amateurs.
Yeah.
And so those would be cozies.
And that's the only thing that qualifies it as a cozy is that it's amateurs, not professionals?
True. Miss Marple is probably the quintessential, if not the first cozy amateur detective.
And do your characters go along the lines of, I always think of women drinking tea and lots of lacy doilies involved when he's in a Mahjong game. I thought of that too. Do they fit that stereotype?
Well, they're modern women. One of them is in real estate. One of them is a professor at the local college. Kiki Coben, who is the lead character here, is a food writer for the newspaper, but she wants to be an investigative reporter. She was a journalism major, and the first job she could get was as a food writer. So there's a lot of food. There's a lot of food in all my books because I write about food.
That's another thing we share, isn't
it?
And tell me about how you got into writing about food. Did you do that before the ministries?
Yes, well before. It was while I was realizing that writing about real violence was just too hard on my psyche. And I had a visit. Actually, first I had a phone call from my then rabbi, who called and said, "Carol, I know you love gardening. My kids seem to think that lettuce comes from the store wrapped in plastic. Can you show them your garden?"
It doesn't.
No. Surprise.
Oh, no.
So I went out and bought a little garden set, and the kids came over. And while we were digging, Jonah asked me, where did the eggplant come from? And I said, "Oh, I bought it at the nursery," and then realized after he left, where did that eggplant come from? So I started researching it, and it fascinated me. Since 1999, maybe? I've been writing about the history of food and how it travels, how it was found. For example, peanuts came from South America. The potatoes came from the Andes Mountains, and there are thousands of varieties. How did they get into Indian food?
So how did they get into Indian food?
There's a long story.
It's a really long story.
One of these days, I would love to publish a collection of those articles.
Yeah. And do you do cooking things too, recipes, things like that?
Yes, I always, depending on what I'm writing about. For example, if I was writing about peanuts, I would give a recipe at the end for peanuts. And I also write about travel. So what is the quintessential peanut recipe from Siena? I don't know. Yeah. I'm just making that up.
Yeah.
But I like to look at foods from around the world to see how they have adopted the food and how they've adapted it to their own culture.
Mm-hmm. I have a bunch of handwritten cards for my grandmother.
Oh, aren't you lucky?
Which have no quantities. Or, you know, it's like a glass of sugar, but you had to know which glass it was to kind of, and I have cookbooks that she edited for a temple sisterhood and things like that, which are crazy. Some of them are things I don't know that you would ever eat. Do you have family collections like that too?
If only. And that's funny you mentioned the glass of this.
Yeah.
My bubby, my grandmother, was a fabulous cook. And it never occurred to me to ask her because I was a kid and I was busy with other things. And then she became ill and I would visit her in the hospital every day to give her lunch. And I asked her, can I please have your recipes? I've never seen them before. Mm-hmm. And she says, if you learn to read and write Yiddish, you can have them.
That's a challenge.
I can read and write and speak Hebrew. She says, no, Yiddish or nothing. And this is 1971.
Yeah.
I moved away. I was living in Israel. And then she died, and no one ever got her recipes. But what she would say, well, glissel, a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
If it looks dry.
And I never got the recipes and have spent my entire life trying to imitate them. I wish she had written them down. My mother never wrote hers down either.
Yeah, but you watched and you absorbed?
Not really. I was busy off. I was doing other things. I was skiing. I was playing with my friends. Whatever I was doing, I wasn't into food as much until I got much older.
Mm-hmm. Do you test the recipes that you've written about, I assume?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I'll receive in the mail from a publisher a cookbook to review. And my goal is to make one recipe from every chapter. And my poor husband has to try them all.
Mm-hmm.
And most recently, I had one an Ethiopian cookbook. Oh, gosh. In fact, I'm going home tonight to make one of the stews because my daughter's coming to visit and I want her to try this. That's one of the pleasures, to try foods from different parts of the world. The seasonings are different depending on what. I mean, you can use cardamom in Morocco or you can use it in Ethiopia, you can use it in India.
It's evocative of culture.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
People. And so you cook like every day? Or leftovers? You eating your own stuff?
Yes. This is an ongoing controversy in our family.
Excuse me, I didn't mean to.
Dr. Marriage Counselor here.
Into that.
I will make a big pot of a stew, and my husband will say, why are you making so much? Why are you making so much? I said, well, because we can serve it today and tomorrow maybe, and I'll freeze the rest for a night on which I don't feel like cooking.
Yeah.
At which point he will turn to me and say, what? You don't feel like cooking? I'm never sure if he's serious about that or not, but we have this discussion several times a year.
Oh, that sounds terrific. We're going to take a break for just a minute. My guest today is Carol Goodman Kaufman. She is the author of The First Murder and her most recent book, Crack Barn Dead, A Cozy Mystery. And we'll be talking about that and some other things about writing in just a minute or two. So please stay with us. You're listening to WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. We'll be right back.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR-FM.
Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield, 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
And from UCP of Western Massachusetts.
UCP of Western Mass is hiring full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. For more information, ucpwma.org/jobs.
WTBR FM is listener-supported radio. That means we depend on your donations to keep the station on the air. All the local content and the music you love requires your support. You can make your donation today at WTBRFM.com by calling 445-4234 or stopping by our studio at 4 Federico Drive in Pittsfield. You'd be glad you did. Pittsfield Community Radio, for the love of radio.
Berkshire County is headed toward a brighter tomorrow, and that future begins with you. The Berkshires are on the brink of falling into a major mental health crisis. Due to the lack of access, many patients, especially children, are waiting months for appropriate care. You can help by advocating for yourself and others to find careers in mental health. Be a mental health hero for the Berkshires. For more information, please visit thebreencenter.org or namibc.org.
Support for this public service announcement comes from Berkshire Community College and Park Square Productions.
This is Kevin Cahill from the Sunday Sounds of Ireland show, which you can listen to every Sunday on WTBR 89.7 at 10 a.m. You will hear the jigs, you will hear the reels, the fiddles, the bowrons, and the bagpipes, Paddy Riley, the Wolf Tones, the Chieftains, and even some cranberries. So listen to the Sunday Sounds of Ireland every Sunday at 10 a.m. here at WTBR 89.7.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. Free community college for any Massachusetts resident without a bachelor's degree at BCC. Find out more at berkshirecc.edu. And from Sundrini Awnings and Home Improvement, providing awnings and canopies in Western Mass. Retractable awnings, retractable screens, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings and screen rooms, customized solutions available. Online at sundrini.com.
Radio for people who used to love radio. Welcome back, WTBR.
And now back to the Morning Drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
And good morning to you. I'm Ellen Speer here in the studio with Carol Goodman Kaufman, a local author, food researcher, and woman of many other talents. We've been talking about her newest books and her projects for the future, and I've been just fascinated by your techniques. And how did you get into the publishing part? Was that new to you? Is that a new world to you about how to get something from a manuscript into a book?
Publishing today, Ellen, is an obstacle course in the nicest terms. I don't want to say just how difficult it is. It's not for the faint of heart. My very first book was done through a traditional publisher, and they were wonderful. They were part of a big conglomerate. Unfortunately, about 3 months after my book came out, if not sooner, it was subsumed by the mothership. The entire staff but one was laid off, including my editor, the marketing department. So even though it had been top of the catalog, it sort of died a death. Even though it got great reviews, didn't go anywhere. So then my next book was, the three picture books. And those I self-published because I wanted them to be read by my grandchildren while they were still young enough to enjoy them. Then came the first murder, and I went to a small press. And that, she did a gorgeous job on the cover. You can see the cover. It's beautiful. And I was very happy working with her. Unfortunately, about 3 months after the book came out, the press folded, which is an ongoing story in the publishing world today. So that was a problem. So I got my rights back after a few months, and I republished under my own imprint, the same Little Cottage Press, which did the children's books. For Crack Bam Dead, I found a new publisher, and they will also be publishing this collection of children's stories coming up. And so far, they've been great to work with.
Now, do you work with an agent, or do you pound the pavement to find a publisher yourself?
I did have an agent for this food book I wanted to write, and we parted ways, friendly, but she was young and she wanted me to have 10,000 Twitter followers. And that's just not me.
You didn't want to spend all day on Twitter?
No, I don't. So I didn't then, and I don't now. I want to be writing. Mm-hmm. So she wasn't going to push the book until I had the 10,000 followers. That's not going to work for me. Yeah. So I started writing other things. And as we know, we read about that exercise, learning a foreign language, learning to play an instrument, doing puzzles will all help you. And I said, well, I need to do something beyond puzzles. What's my favorite puzzle? A mystery. Why don't we try writing fiction? Mm-hmm. So that was how I came to writing mystery. What's my favorite kind of fiction?
Mysteries. So what kind of advice would you give to a beginning writer about what to avoid and what to embrace in terms of going from manuscript to something that somebody else publishes?
First piece of advice I would ever give is to get yourself a really good critique group. That's so important, because if they're good, they will show you not where you're missing a semicolon or you shouldn't have a semicolon. They'll help you move the story forward. I have a fantastic critique group for children's writing that I found through the Society for Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, sometimes called SCIBWE. And we meet about once a month, and I get excellent feedback. We give feedback to each other, and we're all on different genres. Mm-hmm. One is writing fantasy. I didn't know anything about vampires when I started with this group. Now I've learned a lot about vampires. another one writes board books, picture books, and I've been working on a new thing with them. But it's the critique group is the most important thing.
And they critique your mysteries as well, or is that a different group?
That was a different group, which unfortunately fell apart during COVID.
Did you have to assemble it yourself?
Actually, I found them through Sisters in Crime, which is a national organization. The New England chapter co-sponsors the New England Crime Bake, which takes place every November during Veterans Day weekend. And it features workshops and speakers. There's always a guest speaker who's a prominent, popular writer of in the crime genre. It's a fantastic place. I sat down for breakfast one day with a group of women. I didn't know anybody there. Mm-hmm. And we started talking. It turned out they were from my area. And they said, well, you can come visit. We're not accepting new members, but you can come visit us. So I came to visit the group, to see how it went. And I got up, said, thank you so much. This has been really wonderful. And they said, well, we'll see you next month. I said, what do you mean? They said, well, you're part of the group now.
It was a tryout.
It was a tryout, yes.
So you find it very supportive types of feedback, very specific to plot?
That's the ideal form, when you'll say, you know, this isn't working. Your character isn't working. How did you get from point A to point B? It doesn't make sense.
Got it. So they can find the inconsistencies and the things you've got in your head that didn't make it to the page.
Sure. Actually, my husband found something with the first murder. Gave me stitches in my side. Apparently, I wrote that Caleb, the police chief, walked into the office, and three paragraphs later, he walked into the office. I said, oh, my God.
And it was already published?
No, thank goodness. He's a very close reader of my work. He's a big help.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So here's the big question. What's on your nightstand? What do you read?
I just finished a Daniel Silva. I read fun books between my book club books. The one right before that was called Songs for the Brokenhearted, which was wonderful, about Yemenite culture. And upcoming is one called On Her Own. So I read
widely.
I have two book clubs, one in the summer here in the Berkshires and one in the winter. And my husband belongs to it as well. And this summer we've been reading award winners. In the winter we've been reading a lot of American history, because one of our group members happens to be the president of the American Antiquarian Society.
There you go.
So getting great history.
Sure. Do you ever feel pressure in a book club group? You know, oh my gosh, I have to finish this book. I have to get it done before I can show up and talk about it.
If I don't enjoy the book, yes. If I like the book, no problem at all. But I have to read it between 7 and 10 days, starting 7 to 10 days before the meeting, or I will forget what I've read because I'm reading other things as well.
Yeah, yeah. And how does that discussion of other people's work inform your work?
Oh, that is probably the second piece of advice I would give any writer, is to read, and see what works. What is it that captured your imagination while you were reading? Was it the setting? Was it the way the character developed? What annoyed you about this book?
What do you mean?
For example, there's one book I read recently that was just chock full of adverbs. I don't even want any. I tell my students when I do a workshop, I'll say, I don't want any action taking place in July. Leave off the L-Y words. Mm-hmm. If you can't use a strong verb, you're not working hard enough.
Advice that I've heard is that you really have to be ruthless and kill your little darlings.
Kill your darlings, yes.
So how do you go about that in finding them? Mm-hmm. And do you keep them somewhere?
I have a little pile of little darlings. I have a file called outtakes for everything I work on. And sometimes I look at it and say, oh, there must be a way I can put that in there. And then I realize, no, maybe I can use it someplace else, which will get lost. I mean, it goes off. I never see it again. But yeah, darlings are hard.
And what qualifies it as something that you have to murder?
It doesn't fit. It's superfluous. It's adding too much information, or it's an info dump. You don't want anything that's an info dump. For example, as I told you before.
You're recapping. And
the cumulus cloud. You don't want to give information that sounds like a Wikipedia entry. You want the narrative to flow.
And how do you think about dialogue versus description when you write? Are you getting into people's heads? Do you get into the whole thing where you're sort of acting it out in your head as you put it on the page?
Absolutely. I talk to myself a lot. I used to have a dog, and he would put his head on my keyboard, Rascal, and erase things with his head.
Oh, no. And did you get them back after that?
Eventually, yes. But I would talk to Rascal.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when he died, I continued talking, but I guess to myself.
Yeah.
But that's... I'm not talking to myself. I'm talking to my characters and seeing what they would say.
Yeah. You've brought two real books in real paper that I'm holding in my real hand. What do you think about e-books and Kindles versus a real book that you put on your nightstand?
Well, I love a real book. I love the feel of a real book. I love the smell of a real book, especially if it's older and it might have that musty smell. Brings to mind old, if that, you know, that library in My Fair Lady with the rolling ladders. Oh, just what an image of books. But if I'm traveling, Kindle's the way to go because you could put 100 books on that. And if you don't like the one you're reading, you can go to another one.
And do you find that you retain the same way when you're reading something electronic versus on paper?
Pretty much so. Yeah, it's harder to find something, though. If I remember something was on the left-hand side of the page in the middle, I can find it.
Yeah.
In the Kindle, I have trouble with that.
Yeah, yeah. So were you a library person as a child? Did your family cultivate a library habit?
Yes. My mother never learned to drive, so we would walk up or take the bus sometimes and go to the Berkshire Athenaeum, which is now the family and probate court. It was a gorgeous building. With the shiny, the polished wood, it was wonderful. And there were what I called tuffets, little Miss Muffet tuffets. They were little hassocks in the children's room.
Yeah.
And I could very clearly remember getting books and, of course, buying at the book sale with my friends in junior high school later. Mm. But, yes, going up there, I remember reading one book in particular from the children's room. It was about a girl who wanted to be a flamenco dancer, and she turned her first communion dress into a flamenco dress.
Oh, that's great. That's great. I had an affinity for the biographies. There was a section of orange-spined biographies of everybody from Marie Curie to, I don't know, Frank Lloyd Wright. Everybody was in there.
Oh, Nathan Hale was one of my favorites, yes.
And what was it about those as children's books that made them so compelling to us, do you think?
Oh, they were doing such exciting things. I mean, and standing up for principles, accomplishing things. Oh, could I do that? This was in the fourth grade. I was really into biographies.
Sure. Yeah.
What an interesting life. I mean, I lived in a little town. In fact, when years later, we took a road trip through the Maritime provinces of Canada, and we ended up on Prince Edward Island. And my husband was very excited because that's where Anne of Green Gables took place. And as a kid, I had never been to Prince Edward Island. I didn't realize that's where it took place.
So a lot of your life is involved with books, with writing. Mm-hmm. What percentage of your life is devoted to that? And what do you do when you're off duty from writing?
Well, I garden. I exercise. I do a lot of volunteer work.
Is there a garden book in our future from you?
No, I'm not. I could do one on how to fail at gardening.
Well, that kind of relates to the cooking, though, doesn't it?
Absolutely. But my vegetable garden is fairly limited. I have pots and I have an actual garden.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I have parsley and basil. I have tons of mint because you can't control mint.
Yeah.
Recently got rid of I killed my darling oregano because it was taking over. So we do eggplant, tomatoes, various varieties of tomatoes, and zucchini. This year did not have a good successful run with zucchini. Weather is on.
What was it? Yeah.
It was so rainy in June, and then July was too hot and still very hot. I don't know. I think because I was gardening, I got into the history of the foods and then decided to start cooking with those various items, but then went beyond that. I love learning about different foods. Yeah. I had a mission fig tree. I have a key lime tree. I have a citron tree. And I've recently started a kumquat tree, which I love kumquat.
That's serious. That's very serious. So when you're gardening, when you're doing other things, are you kind of writing in your head all the time? And if you are, do you always carry a notebook? How do you capture, you know, when you do, I know I do dialogue in my head and 5 seconds later, I forgot what it was.
That's interesting you should mention that because someone we know is a very successful songwriter and she can get up in the middle of the night and write it out and then go back to sleep. I can barely get up in the middle of the night, much less remember to write it down. Most of my thoughts do come while I'm either in the shower or taking a long walk by myself. I have to be alone because the dialogue has to take place. Trying it out. Would this person say that? And this is a challenge. How do you differentiate one character from the other?
When they're talking to you in your head, you mean?
Yeah. Speaking of which, to go back to Crack Bam Dead.
Yes.
One of the Mahjong players is Dale. And I've sort of modeled her on Bess Marvin, who was Nancy Drew's friend. I don't know why.
Right.
There's something about her that I always liked.
She was kind of a leavening force in a way. You know, she was the level-headed one. What about dreams? Do you find that dreams sometimes, I know some writers have told me, an entire story will show up in a dream and then wake up and it's there fully formed and all they have to do is, it's not all they have to do, but they have to write it down and flesh it out, but they know it all and it's in its entirety it unfolded. Has that ever happened to you?
No, that is a dream of mine, however.
To do the work for you?
Yes, absolutely.
So sleep dreams don't influence you in any way?
No. Not at all.
Have you found that any of your friends worry that something they say or do or a way they act will show up on the page sometime? Do people see you as that reporter who's kind of recording all the time?
Several friends will frequently say, oh, Carol, here's a story for you. Or you can do that. Why don't you take that idea and go along? Although I will tell you, one of the first assignments I had when I joined the mystery writing critique group, it's kind of funny, a call came out for stories for Malice Domestic, which is an annual conference, and they put out an anthology. And every year there's a theme. So Murder Most Theatrical, Murder Most Culinary. Murder Most Culinary was the first one. And I was taking a walk one Saturday afternoon with my husband and started quizzing him about botulism toxin. And then I was asking about other toxins, and he's a physician. And he stopped for a minute, and he looked at me and said, "What are you thinking?"
I don't know if I'm coming to dinner at your house.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, he got a little, I think he was just humorously concerned, but.
Yeah. So, but besides the ideas, do people influence, somebody will say or do something that you say, "I'm taking that"?
Actually, that probably was the impetus for Crack Bam Dead, because I'd been playing Mahjong with this group, and a few of the members had changed, but a new member joined, and we're sitting at the table, and she's taking forever to decide on a tile. Does she want it? Does she not want it? And the rest of us are all rolling our eyes at each other saying, when is she going to do something? And in my head, I said, if she doesn't make a decision in the next 30 seconds, I am going to kill her.
And that became the impetus for the murder?
Yes. I said, when I got home, I said, I probably shouldn't kill her. She's a nice lady. So she's a friend. I should not kill her.
Yeah.
But what if we had a Mahjong group solving murders? And that's where that came from.
Yeah, yeah. So it just comes to you from sitting in a place and you don't know where.
It is magic.
Yeah, yeah. You wrote short stories, too. Can you talk about those? Are they also murder genre?
Well, the Crack Bam Dead are short stories.
I see.
And I've written others that that are independent of the Mahjong group. I'm trying to think of what they are. One was, part of an anthology we had from the group based on holidays that weren't actually traditional holidays. So mine were Black Friday and National Mahjong Day. So actually the one from National Mahjong Day ended up in the collection, but the one Black Friday took place the day after Thanksgiving, and she witnesses a murder, or she thinks she witnesses a murder, but she's agoraphobic because she had been victim of a carjacking.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little tense. She doesn't know what's happening. And it turns out her husband's involved. Another short story has to do with plastic surgery gone way too far.
Hmm.
Actually, it's the plastic surgeon who goes way too far. Huh. And that one's kind of creepy.
Yeah. Now, does the food and the murders fuse at some point? I know you had talked at one point about recipes being in your book or related to food somehow.
Yes. The first murder has a lot of food mentioned. And part of the theme of the first murder is from showing how things can turn upside down as related to the holiday of Purim. And so there are a lot of recipes in there. And then with Crack Bam Dead, Kiki Coben is a food writer. So she brings various pastries to the Mahjong group, and they're always tasting them. So it's just a lot of fun.
Yeah. And will that also be infused in your historical fiction that you're doing, too? Because then you talked about doing a lot of history of food research.
Actually, at this point, I haven't done anything with food other than apples. Those are just eating out of hand apples. I haven't gotten to the point yet where I'm looking at food to include in the book, but I probably should.
Yeah. How long does it take to put a book together, and then how long is the revision process before you feel it's ready?
You never feel it's ready. You can revise from now
to let it go.
From here to eternity. You do have to let go of your, you have to let them fly out of the nest. So I would say probably a year to write it, and then another 3 months to revise it. I'm just spitballing here. I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, no, I know it's going to vary probably from book to book, but I've just, to give folks listening to us a little sense of what the process, what your connection to each of these pieces is before it.
Okay, so how long have you been working on your book?
Oh, Lord. Too long. let's just leave it at that.
Okay.
So are more children's books in the offing, too?
Well, I have a collection coming out shortly. I just received the illustrations.
Right, you're saying that
sending that in to the formatting people to stick it in there. And
when can we be looking for that?
I'm hoping it'll be out within the next few months.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also working on a picture book, but I'm not sure it's going anywhere. So I don't want to even say anything about that.
Okay. Now, do you do the marketing yourself as well, or do you work with other people who market the books for you?
That's a really good question. I did have a marketing professional, and because of his help, I sold close to 10,000 picture books, which is great. But I didn't make any money because advertising is so expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But at least the book got out there. So I do my own social media now, and have an occasional newsletter that goes out about children's stuff, an occasional newsletter that goes out about mystery things.
Yeah, yeah. And have you done readings and your own kind of little book tour?
Oh, yes, doing that.
How does it feel to stand in front of a group and be reading your words? Are you kind of looking at what they're doing? Are you involved in your text?
Well, I read a little, and I try to involve. I like having engagement with the audience, so that's fun. We do a little game. Let's write our own mystery.
And how does that work?
Well, you have to have characters. You need the weapon. You need a motive, and you need a setting. And people will spit out names. They'll send out names. Okay, it takes place on a cruise ship, and the character's name is Vincent. And the murder victim is named Tiffany. And you go on, and then people start writing, well, why is Vincent on the ship? What is he? Oh, he's the bursar. Why is the bursar? Purser.
Mm-hmm.
And the bursar's at college. The purser's on the ship.
There you go.
Why is the purser in her room? Why was the purser in her room? And why does he have an item of her jewelry in his safe in his room? Why do these things happen? And the audience participates, and they throw out ideas. And, oh, he's really his long-lost twin brother.
Mm-hmm.
It goes on and on. The people in the audience really get into it. It's a lot of fun.
Well, this has been a delight. Carol Goodman Kaufman, the author of her most recent book, Crack Bam Dead, A Cozy Mystery. A lot of the Berkshires in her writing. You should look them up. Thank you so much for being here today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ellen. It's been a delight. I can't believe the hour went by so quickly.
It certainly did. Thank you again. I'm Ellen Speer, and you've been listening to Morning Drive on WTBR-FM. Have a wonderful day, and thanks for spending your morning with us.
We'll go with the flow.